Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today for our annual series on women in the judiciary is Judge Esther Steyn. She is a permanent judge of the KwaZulu-Natal Division of the High Court, acting judge of the Electoral Court, and acting judge of appeal for the Supreme Court of Appeal. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Gonyas-Malka, and thank you for having me here. It's a great privilege and an honor.
Welcome, Judge Steyn. To begin with, over a decade ago, you were appointed as judge in the KZN Division of the High Court. And before serving the bench, you were actually involved in academia, lecturing at the University of Western Cape, as well as University of Cape Town. To start with, what triggered your interest into law to follow this passion?
Well, I think I need to start right at the beginning. I literally exchanged my school uniform to start working behind a counter in the Cape Town Magistrates Court because I had a scholarship of the then Department of Justice. And in doing so, it meant that I could work 6 months at the Magistrates Court and 6 months I had to be working and studying at the then Justice College. So I have worked then for my, at that time, doing my BJuris. And the reason why I really, really wanted to become a lawyer was because of what I have experienced in my own home. I did not grow up, and I don't come from an affluent family. It was quite a struggle. My mom was a nursing sister. My father had an administrative work. But in the early hours of the morning, 3 o'clock, our house was surrounded by the sheriff and his staff. And they were there to arrest my father for a debt that was not paid. Now, we all know the background of Section 65 of the Magistrates Court Act, and I don't want to bore anyone with that. But what I can say is that that moment was like a light bulb moment where I realized I don't want anyone to suffer the abuse that my father had to suffer for simply being poor. And I'm going to make it my mission to know about people's rights. And one day I'm going to make a difference, not knowing how I'm going to do it, because despite the fact that in my matric year that I was the head girl of my school and the Duke's pupil, there was no money to go to university. But here was the Department of Justice giving scholarships to people who are prepared to work and study at the same time. And fortunately, with my academic results, I got that scholarship. So that was the reason why I wanted to study law, is to make that difference in people's life. And later on, when I did my LLB part-time at the University of the Western Cape, going to the University of Cape Town, it was a non-brainer when I know that I want to make a difference in for people who are victims of crime. So I was asked by the university, since I was working there and studying, that I wasn't allowed to do a master's by short dissertation. I was allowed to do a master's by dissertation. And the title of my topic was Witnesses, the Stepchildren of the Criminal Justice System. And what inspired me was during my time as a prosecutor and also as a magistrate, when I saw how they have to endure all these obstacles of our criminal justice system. I was hoping that in writing about it and drawing the attention to it, that it will make a difference. At the time of writing my dissertation, there was no victims charter. I can look back today and say, wow, in South Africa, we have a victims charter and we are much more focused on the rights of victims of crime now post 1994 than what we were at that time. I also, at the same time, think that the right to liberty is one of the most important rights that any individual in this country can have. And accordingly, that inspired me to write about bail and pretrial detention. As a young academic at UCT, I was very starry-eyed, and I thought, okay, I will make representations to Parliament on this issue, because at that stage, the new bail legislation was on the books, and it was the 1997 bail legislation. And I said that cannot be constitutional, because in pre-1994, a person arrested for crime, even serious crime, have the right to approach the court and apply for bail. Now you want to make it more difficult in certain instances not allow the person to apply for about 7 days. And eventually, I submitted the memorandum to Parliament, and I was still of the view that it will not be constitutional. And then myself and two other academics wrote on pretrial detention, because we were convinced that the Constitutional Court will not let this legislation pass muster, but eventually we were wrong. So the 1997 legislation went in, sometimes I think it causes some problems, but ultimately there's a perception out there where the public thinks that granting bail means that the courts are just setting people free, forgetting the balancing act of also the person's right to liberty. And I think at the moment in this country, where we have a serious crime problem, more and more you will open any newspaper wherever you go, and someone will say courts need to be more tough on offenders. But what they're forgetting about it is that that person is not yet being convicted. The crime is not yet being proved. And sometimes you're removing that person for a very long time from his or her family. So, yeah, those are the things that really shaped and formed my ideas about justice and what kind of justice I want to deliver one day, should I get an opportunity to be appointed as a judge. My school friend, Corleen, which I've been friends with since the age of 10 years old, always reminded me in 2009 when I was appointed. She reminded me, do you remember when we were in Kennard, we were about 10 years old, and you said, one day I will be a judge in this country. And I forgot about that dream. But yeah, somewhere there might be a little girl in a small town place like Kennard who says, I want to be a judge, and thinking that she can't be because it will never happen. It did.
How does that make you feel that your dream has come to fruition? Because everyone has a dream, but sometimes they don't follow the steps, or sometimes circumstances are just too overwhelming. How does that make you feel?
I think I'm immensely proud of the achievement to be a judge in this country. But at the same time, I also think that it's just a lot of hard work, and there are opportunities for each and everyone. In other words, women previously, before 1994, I remember going to a talk where Judge Leonora van der Heever was delivering a speech to us women who were then in the lower judiciary. I was a magistrate. And I was thinking, wow, how is it possible? Well, that has changed completely. Every woman do not have to think that she will not be able to do it because of her gender. We are equal, and we have the same rights, and we need to just be motivated to exercise our rights. And of course, nothing comes without a lot of hard work, Amalia.
Thinking about the hard work piece and the obstacles, because you've been in this industry for 45 years, What were some of the areas that, and let's say potentially the issues and the challenges that you encountered as you were building your career? And importantly, how did you overcome them?
With a lot of patience, but one of the things, for example, I in 1987, and maybe later on, we can talk about legislation that has changed things for women who want to terminate pregnancies. My story is quite sad about that, but I realized then, so I didn't go through the entire pregnancy in 1989 when my child was born. There was no maternity benefits, for example. In fact, what happened is that I had to take all of my unpaid leave. I had to make sure that I can move forward and accommodate and also take my child to a daycare at the age of 6 weeks. So today things have changed for mothers in the in not only in doing law, but in public service. They have a right to maternity benefits, which are really great and which I think is a big achievement post 1994. The other thing and how I had to overcome is I had good friends in that worked with me, and one friend in particular said, we are equal, and I just think that one is not a strong woman if you start fighting only for a certain group of rights. You have to exercise your right, and if you start saying that, then men start perceiving you as an inferior group, and that inspired me not to stand back, but ultimately to assert myself. At times it could be quite volatile because your opinion wasn't always valued. I've been a magistrate in a small town place called Worcester, where I've just sentenced someone on drunken driving who was by then the third time that he was convicted. So it was a severe sentence. And the chief magistrate, because I was a woman and my prosecutor was a woman, and you had to walk through a particular passage going to the then common room tea room, and he said, "Did you appear in front of these chickens in court?" This was a person that was in charge of my career and my movement, and so you have to ultimately then decide, how do I approach this? Because this is absolute discrimination. But you know what? You go back, you reflect, and what you do then is by ultimately working harder and in the end achieve more. And this very same person, when I was an acting judge, suggested, you can always make use of my services as an assessor, because judges in particularly in 2007 and 2008 were sitting much more with assessors in criminal courts than today. And I just thought, the audacity. And I just never called upon the person to come and work for me. But it took a while. I could either decide, well, I can't deal with this and lay in public charge.
It's a real challenge, and I don't think there's ever a right answer when you're dealing with sensitivities like this and the choices you make. And the choice you made was to work harder and prove who you are. But do you ever think that sometimes people need to be called out publicly because they have been almost indoctrinated into this type of thinking, and that is their view of who women are, based on whatever reasons. But it was pure discrimination.
It was, but I think, you know, if we go back in time and we look at the time then in 1990, this have been in the year 2025, I can tell you that things have changed tremendously. Today, no one will tolerate that. I mean, this, I'm very proud to say that our Chief Justice, who is a woman, have just passed, you know, the sexual harassment policy that has been accepted, and that in itself show to you that there is a change, and it's a change for the good, because no woman, in fact, no person should endure such discrimination from anyone. But it is also the power thing. We have seen it recently also when women do not have the power, and someone in power says that to you, you're left with a sense of injustice. But I'm very positive and about the changes that has came about. And I think today women will stand up, and they will report that immediately. Back then, things were very different. You also had to think that I'm a working mother, I have a career. What will I achieve in the end of the day should I have now lay any complaint? And the complaint is going to be investigated by whom? By men in at that time. It was that imbalance of too many men employed by the Department of Justice and only a few women. So I think I've sort of, the way you deal with it is you, my prosecutor, I've called in and I've said to her, you're welcome to lay any complaint. And her attitude was, don't make it more difficult for me, you know, than it already is, Esther. But yeah, because no one should say that to anyone. I mean, this is just simply, today we would say it's a criminal offense. It's criminal, you know, crimen in jura. Yeah.
Reflecting on your career, can you tell us
Yeah.
about some, or let's say, focal point on one of the most impactful issues or cases that you've been involved with?
It is difficult to pick a specific one because I think there are so many of them, and I'm speaking, I will start off with criminal cases because we as judges do all a whole range of cases where, you know, to pick one rape case above the other would be extremely unfair. But I think in the early years in KwaZulu-Natal, I dealt with a policeman, State versus Cruiser, who murdered his wife, but said it was an intruder. And the police, when they arrived at the scene of the crime, he had a huge bread knife in the visceral area of his stomach. And his defense was, even I was stabbed by this intruder. Eventually it was through a lot of hard work, you know, blood spatter. The investigation of the police was very good, and he was then convicted. And Mornay Cruiser then appealed against the conviction and the sentence, and I've sentenced him to 23 years. The two young children were then without a mother and a father. My colleagues who were sitting as the full court then confirmed the conviction but reduced his sentence from 23 years to 18 years. But be that as it may, that was one of those cases which was in the woman, her whole, the only crime she committed, she was one of her brother, she was she had a twin brother. Twin brother came to testify. He looked like the deceased, which you could see on all the photos, you know, because she was stabbed in the neck and was a couple of times. And then you realize when you look at that, the impact of the crime on the family. And so two young children were now without a mother and a father simply because dad killed mum and dad. And who came to testify in mitigation? Well, the person he had an affair with, who was a teacher. And I was just thinking as I'm sitting there on the bench, I mean, do you know who you care and love? Because, you know, here explicitly, you know, one can see the absolute violence towards his wife. And that was his wife's crime. He already had someone else. And today he has, I think, we've been made a turnaround. He's been on parole for a long time. And the only way I know is one of my acting colleagues, who was then the advocate in front of me defending him, had said that he made a difference and has changed his life around after he came out of prison. Yeah. The other matter is State versus Zuma. It was a full court decision. Myself, Judge Nguni, and my JP Poyet-Olwati, we decided on the Zuma matter in 2019. And we thought, since we our finding is that the there should be no stay of the prosecution, that the matter will be finalized. Well, Amalia, I'm sitting here today, and it is 2025, and the matter, not one bit of evidence has been led in the matter that we thought we dealt with in 2019. There are various matters. One thing I could say is how unfortunate is it for a judge who has never done social media to deliver the first judgment about Facebook in this country. And many people constantly refer me to that in court and say, oh, but in CMC woodworking case, the court allowed, you know, that one can serve by Facebook. And then I can't help sometimes to grin a bit and say, yeah, and did you look at who was the judge in that matter? Because that's not quite what the decision had said. The only thing was, it made a huge difference because there was a change in the rules, and particularly Rule 4. And in this instance, I've said you can't institute proceedings through Facebook, but if there are any other process documents, you can. But I have never been on Facebook. I don't know how Facebook does so. Can you imagine the dilemma you have when you have to write a judgment about something that you now have to start learning about? Yeah.
Your world is fascinating because there is always something happening. There is always a development. And there's a lot of hard work that goes into the things that you do. And one of the elements that I'd like you to share with us a little bit about is when you were involved in the first Presidential Commission on Corruption, and just share with us some of the outcomes and your feelings about this, because it was 4 years of your life.
Yes. Thank you for asking that. The Jali Commission was a very difficult time in my life because on a Monday morning, because I was outside the province, I was the only person from another province. All the other members of the commission team was from KwaZulu-Natal. I came from the Western Cape. And so on a Monday morning, 6 o'clock, you get on a plane. On Friday night at 10, you land back and it came really at the cost of my family. But that's besides it. What is important about this commission, it was the first commission to investigate corruption and maladministration in a public department like correctional services. And what was so amazing is that we've uncovered so much corruption. And it started off small with tenders for a nail that you can use in doing maintenance at the prison that costs 7 rand, and that will then escalate to an amount of 27 rand. And so you can see the same theme that we've heard during the Zondo Commission, our tenders and how certain things were inflated. Well, we have looked at all of that, but more importantly, what we've looked at is also the treatment of prisoners, and that led to what was called the Groot Vlei 4, which is Groot Vlei is a prison here in Bloemfontein, where I am presently. But that wasn't part of our terms of reference. It was four prisoners that made a video of juveniles that are being abused sexually, wardens selling firearms in the prison, distributing drugs in the prison, and the person that was in charge of making the videos was the now Minister of Sport, Gayton McKenzie. He was one of the Groot Vlei 4. Most importantly, in the commission, what we've learned, we have requested the then president, Thabo Mbeki, whether he would expand our terms of reference so that we can investigate this. And we've made recommendations on, well, how to combat the abuse of prisoners inside prison, how to deal with the sexual offenses. You will hear that someone whose sexual orientation, in fact, and today when we know so much more on the LGBTQ, A+ and more, who wants to be a woman who gets then placed inside the male section. And yeah, I think again, the abuse that he, she had to endure was severe. But we have made recommendations to Parliament as to what should and should not happen. And I can only tell you that after that report, which was about 1,800 pages submitted to Parliament by Minister Balfour, I can only say that when I visited the correctional centers, because the term has also changed over the years. In 2015 till 2019, when I was deputy chair of the National Council of Correctional Services, that it was clear to me that our recommendations were not followed. And we thought, we really grappled with the idea, how can we make sure that it won't just gather dust on the shelf? So we said, well, we will entrust the portfolio committee to look at it, whether these recommendations have been ultimately followed. You know, I sometimes listen to the now Minister Groenewald on correctional services, because I'm also a news junkie. I read all newspapers early in the morning, very early. I wish sometimes one could just say to him, but Minister, have you just opened? You don't even have to read the 1,800 pages. Just read the executive summary of the Jali Commission, and then ask your department, which one of these things have we followed? So yeah, it has been really an commission that where I've learned a lot. I've learned about mediation. I've learned about consultation and conflict resolution. And the thing that I've gained from it is that Thabani Jali, who's been the chair of that commission, has been really a mentor to me throughout my legal career. So even when I had to think whether I can, as a Cape Townian, go to KwaZulu-Natal to be a judge there, he supported me and says, yes, of course you can do it. Don't worry. You know, my fear was I can't speak isiZulu, so what will happen? Well, I'm very happy in KwaZulu-Natal division.
Thanks for sharing those impactful moments, Judge Steyn, which not only touched your life, but also meaningful impact in other areas. Given that we are in the month of August, which is obviously a period where South Africa celebrates our
National Women's Day and National Women's Month. And I always find it's a time where we've got an opportunity to think about where we've made gains and also, importantly, what still needs to be changed. This year's theme is Building Resilient Economies for All, Women Leading the Future of Trade. And I want to ask you, as a judge, how do you interpret the theme?
Well, I thought that the person best suited to interpret that will be an economist. So, unfortunately, my husband is the one who studied economy, and not me. But as judges, we have very limited power in changing certain policies. So, what I see is how can women be empowered? And can one do that through the system as we sit as judges in court and decide upon matters? Now, we deal with our matters, impartially, but we can, each one of us can make a difference, because I do think that we need to be very sound and knowledgeable on a number of things. And when one look at the theme, I think that the way we can make a difference is, ordinarily, if you decide on matters. I think we've all read the Vodacom versus Makata matter, which is really something about, business. And so economics and business are intertwined, the one to the other. So yeah, we all have a duty to research more, do more. Whether we can change the lives of other women, I think that's more in the line of whether one can assist where they are vendors and people who want to gain knowledge. But that doesn't fall within our ambit. But because, and I will tell you why, Amalia, we as judges are taught by our training that we should have judicial restraint. And judicial restraint means that we should be cautious, not to stray into the terrain of any other sphere of the which divides the separation of powers. So yeah, my judicial code limits me, and particularly by Article 11, as to do that. Yeah.
But I also think, and this is perhaps a little bit more abstractly
Yeah.
interpreting the theme, when we were talking earlier, you have actually developed a lot of young women from your academic days, trained them up, and they're serving as judges now. So, in effect, you have built part of the generation of resilience that are going out to serve, thinking the market in broader terms.
Yeah, I think it touches on the thing of age. It is immensely important that we should always remember that the achievements of those that we have taught at Varsity and those that we have assisted during our time as academics, that their achievements are their own achievements. And I'm very mindful of not taking credit for any of that. But what is really very, for me, it gives me great pleasure when I see them achieve, or when I go to conferences and they, the lead speakers at these conferences, then you feel, yeah, I've made a difference. But it is like when we look at our own what we consider as being achievements, then everyone in our life, whether it is that teacher that couldn't teach you to speak properly English but taught you all about the life lessons, those are the people that form and shape us. Yeah. So as a woman, I always think that we need to really some. And I'm sure you've heard this so many times, the PhD thing of, pull her down instead of always trying to pull other women up. It for me, it's very important to empower those that come behind me. So I've invested in judges who come and act in my division to sit with them, help them, and teach them to be better judges. And for that matter, I'm still involved in training of aspirant judges. I've been busy with training of newly appointed judges, but that is sometimes it's yeah, the Bridget Mabandla training thing is a brilliant thing, because when you look at the women there, it's women that would never have had the opportunity to enter the judiciary. So yeah, I think that is in a small scale plowing back in what you have received, and I like to try and do that, because if I didn't get opportunities, I would never have been sitting here and be able to talk to you about the judiciary. I would have still most probably be a teacher, because that was the one thing: you either become a teacher or a doctor. And I didn't like a lot of blood, so that would not have. So I would have been a teacher, and I have great admiration for teachers, but in comparison, I love law. So yeah, that's why I ended up being a law teacher. Yeah.
Well, you found your path, you found your calling. And lastly, as we close up today's show in celebration of Women's Month, please share a few words of inspiration or motivation you'd like to pass on to women and girls that are listening to us.
Definitely. I think if there's some young woman thinking that she's sitting at a law school, not knowing whether she would be able to even qualify her degree. I've been there. I've been in my first year of studies, and I didn't want to finish it because I was far away from home and I was 18 years old. And I've said to my mom, I'm going to come home. And mom said to me, my girl, we never quit. And that inspired me, because if you start, my mom's words were, if you start something, you finish it. And that's really what I would like them to do, is to if you start an law degree, even if you think law is not for you, it will be a good tool to use later on, whether you want to enter business or whether you want, it's always a good tool. And I've always told my students, this is what you should do. And the second thing that I firmly believe in is that there's only, and I've said to you, I love reading. There's only one thing that I want them to know, that you must keep on dreaming, because the only thing that will make your dream impossible is your fear of not achieving that dream. So don't be fearful. If you have a dream, make that your reality. But that reality comes with a lot of hard work and a lot of time. And I will be definitely the first to tell them that we've heard that from all of our law lecturers when we were young, that the law is a jealous mistress. Well, I can tell you, it is a reality. Many Saturdays and Sundays, when your friends and everyone will be socializing, you will be sitting reading and preparing for your cases, and you will be writing, because judges also owe a duty to the public to deliver judgments timelessly. And for that matter, that's why we took an oath of office, is to do that in a proper fashion, and to do that in every matter that we touch, because one matter may appear to be more important than the other, but for the litigant, it is his or her most important matter, and maybe their only time that they will litigate in the High Court. So never give up. That is my belief.
Thank you so much for sharing your journey with us, your passion for the law, and imparting that special message that we're actually responsible for writing our own story. So go and live your dreams, take ownership of the ups and the downs, and see it through. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amalia. I really enjoyed this talk. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Judge Esther Steyn, who is a permanent judge of the KwaZulu-Natal Division of the High Court, acting judge of the Electoral Court, and acting judge of the Supreme Court of Appeal.